Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu, and I'm back with my co-host, Dr. Sam Mazier, and our producer, Trevor Hogue. Did I pronounce that right? All right. Hey, guys. Yeah. How are you guys doing?
What's up?
What's up? Our guest tonight is Dr. Carlos Prada, here to discuss neurofibromatosis type 1. But first, Sam, can you remind us what we do on the show?
I'd love to. We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
Today, we have a fantastic conversation with our host, Dr. Carlos Prada. Dr. Prada is the Division Head of Genetics, Genomics, and Metabolism at Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital at Northwestern University, where he dedicates his clinical and research efforts to advancing care and therapies for neurofibromatosis and lysosomal storage disorders. He's been instrumental in developing genetics programs in Colombia and the Dominican Republic, fostering clinical genetics training abroad, and hosting international students for research and clinical collaborations. He's passionate about expanding access to genetic care, so he combines leadership in clinical trials and gene therapy with a commitment to mentoring future genetics professionals. He teaches us about the common clinical presentations and diagnostic criteria for NF1, how not all hyperpigmented skin lesions are cafe au lait spots, and the next best steps for managing a new NF1 diagnosis.
All right, I'm excited about this topic. Our audience has no need to get nervous about it, as we're going to spot what we're going to need to know about this condition. No.
Yeah.
We'll take it. I had AI good. Look it up. I'm sorry. I had nothing. Yeah. Hello, Dr. Prada. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for the invite.
First, because we're an informal group, I'd like to ask, is it okay if we call you by your first name?
Yes, that's fine. Call me Carlos.
Mm-hmm. So, Carlos, excellent. Just as we get to start to, for our audience to get to know you, could you give us a little bit of something to describe yourself, maybe who you are, and a little bit of something out of medicine that you like?
Yeah. So, I'm a pediatrician and geneticist, and I also do research. I work in Chicago. I'm really passionate about global access to kids with rare conditions. I really love Colombian coffee. I'm from Colombia. I like travel, hang out with my wife, Katie, and two kids, Charlie and Emma, and my dog, Flynn. He's a Shishon, yeah. Like for the genetics aspect, yeah. I do. I really like walking and biking, and even in the winter, yeah, which is a new challenge for me. Yeah.
Nice, yeah. Nice.
Well, we'll get into some of our questions if that's all right. Yeah. Chris, did you have a follow-up to that?
No, you or Trevor, you guys are next.
All right, we'll take it away. So, Trevor, I'll ask the first one, you go for the second one. So, my first question, we kind of ask a lot of our guests this, but I was hoping you could answer, what would be your favorite failure, and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was working on a new treatment for a treatment concept for a rare genetic condition. Yeah. And despite the drug being a good idea and we had a lot of excitement about it, there was a lot of unanticipated challenges that we did not knew how to handle in terms of regulatory aspect, but also engagement of the all the stakeholders. Yeah. So even though we were not able to take this medication into full development, it really helps me a lot about the importance of looking not only about the biology and the application, but also how to engage patients and investors for a project to be successful. Yeah.
Yeah. And some good real-world advice there for us who are trying to say, hey, we got a great idea, but how do you actually get that idea forward and how do you actually put it out there for the world? So thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. And my question, which is also another popular question you might hear here at the Cribsiders, what is the best advice you've received as a learner?
I guess probably the best one will be just to learn the why of something, not just like memorize the facts. Yeah. It just really digging deeper into the mechanism and look at the context, of an issue, rather than every fact. So I think that will help you. That will help you become more practical and go from theory to practice. Yeah.
Well, we are going to ask you a whole bunch of questions similar to that, you know, and hopefully understanding a little bit of the pathophysiology behind what we're going to talk about tonight might be might help us all as learners. EZ Resus is your ultimate support to take care of your sickest patients during resuscitation. Whether you are taking care of a newborn during a precipitous delivery, a septic child requiring endotracheal intubation, or a seizing teenager, this offline app has drug dosing, equipment size calculation, treatment algorithms all available in under 3 clicks. This gives you rapid access to life-saving critical info in a user-friendly interface, taking care of the logistics of resuscitation so you can take care of what really matters, your patient. For those who do not work with critically ill patients, the app also has calculated doses of the most used PO and IV medications, including antibiotics and analgesia. Also, you can find critical first steps for basic and advanced life support, which could be useful for anyone, anywhere. Finally, for those in our audience who also work with adult patients, there is a complete adult section with the same features as in pediatrics, including weight-adjusted dosing for heavier patients, treatment algorithms, and more. So someday you'll need to act outside of your comfort zone, and with EZ Resus, you will be ready. So CryptCenter's listeners, here are the benefits. They're made for all clinicians and all patients with a user-friendly interface, 100% offline content and available on any device, drug dosing, treatment algorithms, and equipment size dynamically calculated based on patient characteristics, multiple alerts and content adjusted to age and weight to ensure safety, content entered and reviewed by over 30 healthcare professionals, and available for institutional access, including an online version, group pricing, customizable content, and exclusive features. So, listeners of the Cribsiders get access to a 2-month free trial, letting them use 100% of the features of the app. So download EZ Resus on the App Store or Google Play Store, create your account, use code Cribsiders, that's code Cribsiders, and then start using EZ Resus. And for more information, visit www.ezresus.com/Cribsiders. That's www.ezresus.com/Cribsiders. And lastly, for learners, that's students and residents, the app is completely free for the first 2 years. I'm trying to figure this out. Trevor, do you want to get started on this case so we can get into the good stuff?
Yeah, I'll take it away. So Von Reck is a previously healthy 5-year-old boy who presents to his annual well child check with his mom as she feels like he's been having difficulty with his vision recently. She's noticed him squinting more out of his right eye and complaining of headaches, especially after watching TV or playing on his iPad. Mom also mentions she thinks the areas of skin spots on his chest and back discussed at his last well child check seem to be getting larger. Von says these spots aren't itchy or painful. On exam, he has normal vital signs. He's noted to be in the 25th percentile for height, has a visual acuity of 20/70 in the right eye and 20/20 in the left, with normal red reflexes bilaterally. Additionally, he has a total of 8 hyperpigmented macules, all greater than 5 millimeters, scattered across his back, trunk, and his extremities. So Von's symptoms seem to be kind of all over the place, touching on a few different systems all at the same time. Can you talk about a little just exactly what neurofibromatosis type 1 is and the pathophys behind it and its clinical manifestations?
Yes, great question, Trevor. So neurofibromatosis type 1, or NF1, as we use it more in the clinic and with patients, is one of the most common genetic disorders, has a frequency of 1 in 2,000 live births. The most common manifestations are the skin. You mentioned the caffeolae spots in the case, but something called neurofibromas, which are enlarged nerve roots. Yeah? And is a what we call a multisystemic disorder. It affects not only the skin or the nerves, but it affects the brain functioning, and has a predisposition for developing tumors. Yeah? So a good analogy is if you think of a traffic light, so the NF1 really controls the red-green. Yeah? If it's always green, that means the cells are always growing, and that's what leads to the overgrowth of the nerves, overgrowth of the cells that can become malignant or can become problematic for these children. Yeah?
So maybe we'll get a little bit more into that pathophysiology that you were mentioning. So can you kind of talk to us about what is wrong in NF1? Like mm-hmm. What does NF1 gene do from that perspective?
Yeah, so the NF1 gene encodes a protein called neurofibromin. And neurofibromin is a really important protein in a pathway called the RAS pathway. Yeah. And that protein, what it does is just signals the cell to grow, proliferate. Yeah. And it does a lot of different roles important for cell division, growth, signaling inside the cells. Yeah. And that is what it leads to the overactivation through this pathway. So we all use NF1. We all have two copies of the NF1 gene. And we only need one copy to not work in order to develop neurofibromatosis. Yeah? And when you lose the function of that gene, leads to this overactivation of the RAS pathway that then leads to the tumors and the manifestations of the condition. Yeah. So what we would like is that function of the gene to be normal again for a child not to develop the complications. Yeah.
So one question I have is with the inheritance then. So you said it happens in 1 in 2,000, which seems like very, very common. So that means there are a lot of, and this is it autosomal or is it, does it come out de novo? And these seem to be very common mutations that people seem to carry without symptoms.
Yeah, correct. So it's a common rare condition. Yeah. So it's kind of a, so in my practice, I think neurofibromatosis one of the most common disorders I see. Yeah. So 1 in 2,000 is actually quite common. Yeah. In our program, we do follow over 1,000 children. Yeah. So we have a busy practice. Yeah. When we talk about inheritance, yes. So it's a dominant condition. That means only one gene variant is needed to cause disease. Yeah. Now, being genetic doesn't necessarily mean that we won't see inherited, yeah? So 50% of the patients we see, one of their parents could be affected with the condition, and 50% are what we call de novo, so that means a genetic variant that happened in the child and there's no family history. Now, NF1, it can be a little bit more complicated, that also we see something called mosaicism or segmental NF1, so that means the actual genetic change did not happen on the first the sperm or the egg, but it was post-zygotic, so after fertilization. Down the line, there could be a somatic change, and that can be, you can have NF1 only of your arm or leg, or in some specific layer of the embryo, not in every cell. Yeah, so that will be a mosaic NF1. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you for that. I've not heard of the red and green like light pathway to describe the mutation, so that is a good analogy. What are some of the most common presenting symptoms of NF1 that you see? If you see so many kids, like, I guess, what would our like outpatient pediatrician or a kid like this child described in the case, what would they be most likely to identify at their well child check?
So first, the name was a really good one. Yeah, it should put you in the right track. Yeah, your case is actually very good. So that's a very common presentation. So let's talk about the skin findings. So Caffella spots is probably the main reason we get patients referred to our clinic. Yeah, so I'll say like at least we get one or two kids that are referred for Caffella spots as a rule out. Neurofibromatosis type 1 in our practice. Yeah, they usually show up pretty early, so it could be soon after birth, at birth, or in the first few months. Yeah, but it becomes more obvious during the summer. Yeah, so the summer the kid is out a lot, and then you see the Caffella spot a little bit easier. So we tend to get a lot more referrals right after or during the summer, after the summer, compared to the winter months. So that is the most common reasons why pediatricians will send a patient to us. Yeah. Now, the other ones are when kids are having symptoms, so such as vision loss. Yeah. So that's a concerning feature, that someone may have optic glioma, which is an overgrowth of the optic nerve. So an ophthalmologist that is very familiar with the condition could actually see the raised optic nerve disc or some sort, not necessarily papilledema, but could see a little bit of fuzzy borders around. That will lead us to do a brain MRI to rule out this possibility. Now, the neurofibromas, which are the hallmark of the disease, what you will, if you Google the condition, they typically don't show up until puberty. Yeah, so they are helpful if one of the parents show in the to your office, and the parent is the one that has the neurofibromas. Yeah, so if you see the Kafele spot, then you put it together. So this is one condition that you should examine the parents if you can. Yeah, I know pediatricians may be uncomfortable examining the mom or the dad, but it's actually a fairly non-invasive exam. So let's look for some of the skin findings, the Kafele spots or some neurofibromas, and then you gotta check the armpits. Yeah, where you can see the freckles, which are typically in areas not exposed to sunlight. So that's why we check the axilla and the inguinal region. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could describe a little bit, what do you mean by a cafe au lait spot? Mm-hmm. And also, like, how few or how many is mm-hmm. too many? And what, because it can be sort of, I don't know how to say, yeah, maybe difficult to mm-hmm. say, like, mm-hmm. I see one or two. Should I start worrying about this? When should I start thinking about NF1 more during my examination?
Yeah, so yeah, one or two should be fine. Yeah, don't raise any flags on that. Yeah, if they are usually six. Yeah, so if there's six or more, that will be the first criteria is met for the diagnosis. Yeah, now this is a genetic condition, but the clinical criteria are actually very good to make a diagnosis. So it's probably the patient population that I used to order the least amount of genetic testing, just because the clinical features are so good for the diagnosis that we didn't need to, yeah? And did not used to change our management. Now we use it a lot more because it's more accessible, yeah? Six or more Kafele spots. If the child is young, before puberty, usually about 5 millimeters in size, yeah? If the child is post-pubertal, it has to be at least 15 millimeters in size. So you should take that into account, yeah? Kafele spots are just brown color macules, yeah? And they can be anywhere in the body, so the location doesn't matter. So we usually do a head-to-toe skin examination looking for those. The typical Kafele spots for NF1 are like clear borders, yeah? So there are, when you look at Kafele spot, there's different types of Kafele spot. There's some that have like very regular borders. So those are not the typical NF1. The size is only important if it's 5 or 15. It doesn't matter if it's 3 or 4 or 5 centimeters. It doesn't really give extra points or less points. And it doesn't really matter if you have 6 versus 20 or 30, that doesn't give you any severity. You just need at least 6 to make the diagnosis. Yeah. So that's criteria number 1. 2 are the freckles, yeah, in the axilla or inguinal region, which are non-exposed to sunlight. Yeah. Those are probably the second most common criteria we find on children. Now, it's also important that most kids, when they're young, don't meet criteria until they're about 5. So it's not unusual that maybe we get a child that only has Kafele spots and don't have the freckles or other features. That doesn't necessarily mean that child doesn't have NF1, especially if it's a 1-year-old or 2-year-old. You need to continue to follow until they're 5 just to feel confident that they don't really have any of the other features. Yeah. Or you can do the genetic testing, yeah, especially when there's anxiety, yeah, that may actually help solve the case a little faster, yeah. But the other criteria is the family history. So, and I mentioned that 50% of the patients we see in clinic, one of the parents has the condition, yeah. So if a first degree relative, such as a parent or a sibling, has the condition, then you only need another clinical criteria to make the diagnosis. So two criteria to make clinical diagnosis of NF1, yeah? Genetic testing is now included as a criteria, but you have to have at least one other criteria to make the diagnosis, yeah? the challenge with genetic testing is that there's a lot of what we call private genetic variants. So that means they're unique to the patient, so they're not reported anywhere. So that's the relevance of having the clinical context before you just defer or to the genetic testing alone. That could be that could get you in troubles later. Yep. Now, the eye exam is very important. There's two features there. One are the Leish nodules, which are hamartomas of the iris. They don't cause any visual problems, and they're just pigmented, like pigmented macules of the iris, but you need a slitless lamp in order to identify them. So you need to actually refer a patient to the eye doctor to confirm that, yeah? And so you need at least two Leish nodules to make that to be the other criteria. And the other one is the tumor of the optic nerve, which we call optic glioma, that may need imaging, a brain MRI to actually diagnose that. Yeah. And there are other findings such as neurofibromas, which I explained, they will show up typically during puberty, so don't. You can see them early on. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's more severe, but it's usually not present during the initial evaluation, especially of a young children, unless those are the something else that we call plexiform neurofibromas. Yeah, sorry for all the terminology. Yeah, so plexiforms are larger neurofibromas that can happen in any nerve as well. That don't have to be superficial. They can be profound, like inside the muscle or inside the body as well, like close to the spine, yeah. So there are a lot of common locations for this plexiform neurofibromas. One thing that can help you distinguish them is that when they're superficial, they can be a lot darker, yeah. They can darker, they can have a little bit of texture on exam, they can have hair, yeah. So that may help you identify them. And they're usually raised and usually more than 3 centimeters, usually in size. So that can give you a clue that someone can have a plexiform, yeah? So that is another classical feature. And plexiforms can happen at any age, but they can be early in life. So they can be congenital, they can show up early during infancy. So those could actually help you make the diagnosis as well, yeah? And there are other criteria that are a little harder to see, such as sphenoid wing dysplasia, which you will need imaging, yeah? And usually secondary to an underlying plexiform in that area of cranium. And then there's something else called a tibial pseudoarthrosis, which is an abnormality of the tibial bone that can predispose to fractures, yeah? Early, so bowing. Kids with an F1 can have unilateral bowing of the tibia, and that may be a feature of this complication called pseudoarthrosis, yeah, which is really, if it fractures, it takes a long time to heal and may need a lot of orthopedic surgeries. So that could also be a clue to the diagnosis, but it's less common than the other features, yeah. And those are probably the most common manifestations on a child with an F1, yeah.
So that is a lot, and it sounds like all the manifestations kind of go into the clinical criteria, which we will take a step back mm-hmm. and talk about one more time in a second. I just wanted to say from the manifestation standpoint, let me see if I can summarize this right.
Okay.
So it sounds like we have cafe au lait macules, hopefully greater than 5 millimeters in the young one, and then over puberty, greater than 15 millimeters. We have neurofibromas, which won't probably show up until later, again, in the puberty area. But then we also have the kind of the inguinal freckling or the axillary freckling. And then in the eye, we have optic gliomas. We also have iris hamartomas, which are also known as Leish nodules. And then we have the bony disease processes. And that's like that sphenoid wing dysplasia that you were mentioning, or the pseudoarthrosis, which we'll have to get into in a second.
Yeah.
Am I covering all the symptoms kind of, or are we missing any other tumors anywhere?
Yeah, so those are the symptoms that are more unique. Yeah. The other common symptoms are learning difficulties. Yeah. So child with an, but they're less specific, so less likely to make you able to make the diagnosis. So attention deficit, learning difficulties, probably 50% of children with an F1 will have a degree of a learning difficulty. They can have large heads, yeah. So macrocephaly, again, non-specific, but a common feature. They can be short for their family, yeah. Not like severe short stature, but relatively short to their family. And then the other tumors, so the plexiform neurofibromas that can happen on any nerve, and they can also have different types of brain gliomas as well. Yeah.
And then, so from a pathophysiology standpoint, it sounds like we have RAS, you know, the NF1 gene is a, you know, is a RAS inhibitor, or at least RAS pathway. And that it sounds like we are overproducing something just like any sort of tumor. It sounds like most of them are benign. How does the cafe au lait spot, which seems to be the thing that we should all notice and recognize, how is that like a, of the world of tumors? It seems like it's kind of completely separate process that somehow you got that, or is cafe au lait actually a overproduction of something in the skin?
Yeah, so yeah, good question. So yes, yeah, so typically it's secondary to the loss of the neurofibromin on this melanocytes, yeah, and that leads to overproduction of melanin, and which leads to the hyperpigmentation as well, yeah. And typically when I mentioned, remember when I mentioned the mosaics, yeah, so if a child, mosaic means that it's not in every tissue, so sometimes if we do blood testing to try to find the genetic variant, we cannot find it. So we usually go to a cafe au lait spot and do a biopsy of a cafe au lait spot because we're more likely to find the genetic change on those cells, yeah? So that becomes helpful from that standpoint, yeah? And I probably should probably clarify, so NF1 is a tumor suppressor gene, yeah? So in, yeah, if you lose the function, you have to lose the second copy, and that's when you develop the tumors, yeah? And that's when it becomes the more accelerated growth in the cells, yeah?
Ready to optimize your nutrition this year? Factor is back again with chef-made gourmet meals that make eating well easy. They're dietitian approved and ready to heat and eat in 2 minutes, so you can feel right and feel great no matter what life throws at you. Remember, Factor arrives fresh and fully prepared, which is perfect for the busy medical lifestyle. Factor even did their own study on weight loss, finding customers can lose up to 8 pounds in 8 weeks with Factor keto meals. One of their greatest assets is their variety. So with over 40 options across 8 dietary preferences on the menu each week, it's easy to pick meals tailored to your goals. And if you want more than pre-made meals, Factor also offers help with feel-good smoothies, grab-and-go snacks, and more add-ons. My goals are to put a meal on the table immediately, and Factor helps me reach that in a record time. Just 2 minutes with ingredients I can trust and convenience that can't be beat. So Crib Setters listeners, eat smart with Factor. Get started at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off and use code cribsiders50off to get 50% off your first box plus free shipping. That's code cribsiders50off at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. And I'm going to kind of move us a little bit just because we've already kind of talked a fair amount about this, about diagnosis. You know, you had mentioned you either have two of those kind of clinical criteria that we mentioned, which is the, some of the skin findings, the eye findings, the bone findings, the family history, or genetic testing plus one of the clinical findings.
Correct.
Are there any tests that you have to send to kind of make some of these clinical finding criteria? What I'm trying to say is like, do we get x-rays on all these kids to look for those phenodysplasia? Do we have to do some blood test that would change, that would find something in the eye? You know, obviously that doesn't make sense, but that type of question is what we're kind of going for.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So at this point, no. So clinical criteria are probably the most effective way in family history. The genetic test is usually a blood test. You can also do it in saliva now, which will work for the majority of patients with the exception of the mosaic segmental patients, yeah, that you will need some sort of biopsy in order to confirm the result, yeah. If you have a good ophthalmologist, or not necessarily good, but familiar with the condition, their assessment probably is good enough for the Leish nodules and maybe when do you need to do an MRI. We could do MRIs, and that could help you notice the sphenoid wing dysplasia or the optic nerve hyperplasia or the enlargement of the optic nerve, but that requires sedation. Yeah, so we only do it if we really are concerned about a child that has symptoms. Yeah, but also in places that you may not have access to an experienced ophthalmologist, that may be another way to screen for that complication as well. Yeah.
Okay, so we've been kind of talking about all of these symptoms. When I know these processes are pretty unique to NF1 maybe, When you're thinking of NF1, what are some other good differential diagnoses, or are there any NF1 mimics?
Yeah, there are actually. So we'll see how many you have heard. this one called Legius syndrome. Yeah, you know that one. Yeah, Legius is due to a genetic variant on a gene called SPRAD1. Yeah. And actually, it's a mimic. They have cathode response, very similar to the NF1, yeah? But they don't develop tumors. Yeah? They may have macrocephaly and large heads and some learning difficulties. But I will say, for every 100 patients I diagnose with NF1, I find one with Legius. So relatively rare. So good to have in your differential, but very rare in comparison, yeah? One that may be more prevalent, and you probably have heard about this one, Noonan syndrome. Yeah. So Noonan syndrome may present with cathode response. There is a subtype of Noonan called Noonan syndrome with multiple lentigines. Yeah. I have encountered patients with NSML or Noonan syndrome with multiple lentigines that have been diagnosed with NF1, but when we do the genetic testing, we find that it's a genetic variant on PTPN11, which is one of the genes that causes this type of Noonan. Yeah. So that may be a helpful aspect of doing genetic testing for some of these patients, yeah? There used to be a condition called Noonan neurofibromatosis, yeah? But now it's known that this actually neurofibromatosis, it was not Noonan, yeah? So the actual underlying gene is NF1, and it's basically, they look like Noonan, but they actually have NF, yeah? So it's another category, yeah? Then McCune-Albright, yeah? Which is another condition that can present with cathode spots, yeah? But those cathode spots are more irregular, yeah? And they usually have bone and endocrine involvement, yeah? Which is different than NF1, yeah? Although NF1 can also give you precocious puberty as well, yeah? And that should make you think about the risk for a brain tumor, yeah? That is leading to that. So maybe some overlap there as well. And there is a couple of genes in the area of cancer that are like mismatch repair genes that can present with cathode spots. And there's some recent publications showing that they can be NF1 mimics from the cathode spots. So you should think about those other conditions that maybe actually can present later on with cancer, yeah, which will be important to rule out as well. Yeah. So there's a good differential for cathode spots, yeah. And one that is opposite, which is hypopigmented, yeah, macules, but sometimes you can see both. Some kids that have a couple hypopigmented macules should make you think about tuberous sclerosis, which is another, it's not in the RAS pathway, but it's a neighbor pathway, the mTOR, yeah, that it should make you think about that as well, yeah.
And that actually makes me kind of want to talk about genetic testing for a second, because so say a lot of these kids, right, get referred to you because of cafe au lait spots. So say you have six or more cafe au lait spots, you're like, all right, six, that's all they have, right? So it sounds like based on a lot of this differential, you could have a couple of these disease processes. Say you say, okay, cafe au lait spots, then send your genetic testing. Mm-hmm. Are you testing like just NF1, or are you sending a panel that includes, because if it's cafe au lait spots and NF1 negative, then you're like, uh-oh, what do I do? Mm-hmm. Or are you automatically sending some like cafe au lait spot panel that we should know about?
Yeah, so sometimes it's what I want, but sometimes it's what the insurance wants. But also, it's also what the family wants. So I think, honestly, for us, because of the frequency of an F1 being that high, we probably will do NF1 with Legius, just because those are the Legius being the least common, but at least it's a good reflex if there's nothing else going on with the child. Yeah, if the child has history of pulmonic stenosis, which is more to me a finding of another rhesopathy, yeah, but can also happen in an F1. I will probably use a panel test, so of RAS genes that are usually 15, 17 genes, yeah. But then as you increase the amount of genes you do, the more chances of having uncertainty also comes high, but bigger the catchment of a diagnosis as well, yeah. So I'll say if the concern is cathode spots alone, it's probably fine to do NF1 or NF1 plus SPRAD1, which is Legius, yeah. If there are more symptoms that are not classical of NF1, yeah, that are not in those NIH criteria that we review, then I'll go with the RASopathy panel, especially if I see other features. And if it's neither of that, then yes, you probably can go bigger and do an exome if these more atypical features, yeah, which is not unusual. We sometimes get a referral for Cafella spot, but the Cafella spot is the least of the concerns, and there's a lot of other congenital anomalies that we may not explain with an F1, and we'll probably do an exome. Yeah. Now, exome is a sequencing of all the sons of the genome, yeah.
So it sounds like maybe you can get, all right, you send your NF1 plus or minus Legis, and then if that comes back negative, then the insurance company will generally pay for the next level. Is that what you've found?
It depends. So sometimes insurance prefer, it's just a different science. Depends where you practice, yeah. So let's say if I was in Ohio, yeah, and in Cincinnati, they used to like to pay more panels, yeah. And here in Chicago, they like to pay more for exomes. I don't know the science of that, yeah? But sometimes there's other implications that come with the bigger panel. You have to counsel family more about incidental findings, about secondary findings, which are other genes that are not the reason why we're doing the test, that they may have another variant in a gene associated with BRCA and what that means for the family. So they just require more counseling. They're not necessarily better, or it just requires more education. Yeah, we do have genetic counselors too as well with us in our team, so that kind of helps educate families better in that decision process too. Yeah.
So when we're thinking of this, like let's say this patient is at he's at his well child check, does the age, when we're going through like the 6 or 7 diagnostic criteria, does the age does that factor into it? I know it can present with different times with different symptoms, but do you think of that?
Yeah, it matters. So most kids don't meet criteria clinically until they're 5. Yeah. There's some that will do it early. So if you have a child that is younger than 5 and you only see one criteria, that kid still can have an F1, just require a re-examination. Yeah. But I will probably refer that child because the eye exam, that's something that can be subtle, yeah? And it can be silent until it presents with decreased vision, and you want to be able to treat that child before that vision is overly affected, yeah? But if a child is over 5, yeah, I think the clinical criteria are pretty reliable, yeah? Again, family history will help you. 50% of the patients will have a parent. That doesn't necessarily mean the parent knows has an F1, yeah? So I will say that almost 50% of the parents we diagnosed, they didn't know they have it, yeah? But again, that comes with the experience as well, yeah? But yeah, I think that's a good question. Age matters, and the older the child is, the most likely to meet the clinical criteria on exam, yeah?
And while it's not necessarily like a diagnostic criteria, do you ever see NF1 presenting as like a new onset seizure, especially in a kid? Like, would you see that in the emergency department or anything just because of all of the like neuronal involvement?
Not the most often. Seizures is not the most common complication we see with NF1. It can happen, yeah, especially if there's a tumor, and there's also, as you mentioned, some cortical defects that maybe can predispose to seizures. But it's not necessarily the most common manifestation, but it can. It can present. So it's not necessarily a condition that, to me, red flag as an automatic should think about an F1 unless it has 6 Cafella spot and other features, yeah? One that I did not mention is elevated blood pressure. So that's something we always check, yeah? And actually, the most common reason for elevated blood pressure on NF1 is renal artery stenosis, yeah? So you may need additional testing, ultrasound, Doppler, or sometimes MRI to really make that diagnosis. But that will be another important aspect of checking the blood pressure, which is hard in children. Yeah, they're always moving and crying, and you don't know if it's real. Yeah.
All right. So, you know, we're sort of getting into things that we're going to do afterwards. So I want to go along with that. So we have our patient here. We've had our clinical assessment. We've already done maybe some early things, maybe biopsy, maybe some genetic testing. You know, maybe we've already had eye imaging, and then you just brought up maybe some renal stuff. What are our next necessary steps we have to make sure we get done outside of that? Like, what are the things that we say we need to get this done because maybe there's something worrisome that might make us be more urgent or emergent things that we need to do?
Yeah, so for a new diagnosis, so basically it comes with a lot of education about the condition and a lot about anticipatory guidance. Yeah, so first thing, not every child develops a tumor complication. Yep. It is very common to have the neurofibromas. You talk to, this is a later complication during puberty and early adulthood. Yeah. Optic gliomas are typically, with the tumor of the optic nerve, typically develop and present symptomatically usually before age 8. Yeah. So that's something that we, when we make a diagnosis, we do yearly eye exams, yeah, to make sure that is good. Yeah. And after age 8, that risk goes down by a lot, so we may not worry as much for that. Yeah. And then there's no routine screen for brain gliomas outside the, again, the medical history. We are not necessarily doing brain MRIs in every child with an F1, yeah, unless there's a clinical concern, such as headache or a seizure or or something unusual in the eye exam, that's what will lead us to do a brain MRI. Yeah. Check the blood pressure as one of the other complications that may need early treatment. And then the plexiforms. The plexiforms are the neurofibromas that can be deep in the spine or inside the body or close to the trachea, yeah, or they can push into important organs as well. So for that, there's not a specific guideline. And actually, there was a study that surveyed most of the NF1 centers to see, will you order a screening whole body MRI? Will you order a spine MRI only? Will you do a regional MRI? Yeah. And there was no, probably in children, probably 20% of NF1 specialists will order a whole body MRI unsedated if the kid can do it without sedation. Yeah. That's 1 out of 5 NF specialists. So it's not necessarily the most common recommendation. Yeah. But 90% will do an MRI or a whole body MRI or a regional MRI if there's a symptom. Yeah. And so those symptoms will be an unusual weight gain, back pain, unexplained pain that is not related to trauma, but it just doesn't go away. Yeah. Normal reflexes. So we actually do rely a lot on the clinical assessment. Yeah. Or a growing mass, a lump that leads to imaging. That actually may change. So my expert opinion at this point is, and part of my research is, I do whole body MRIs, yeah, and children to know if they have a plexiform that we should be aware of, because now there's a treatment that can help reduce the size of those a specific type of tumors. So I anticipate that recommendation may change or evolve over time. Yeah. And people start using more screening MRIs because now there's a potential treatment that you can use before they become symptomatic. Yeah. And so that area is evolving at this time. Yeah. And then learning. So a good developmental history, good information about resources. We have a social worker in our program, so which makes sure families are aware of what they can request in the school, yeah, what kind of nearby resources are for family and education and learning. And we do try to do developmental assessments as they start first grade, so we can anticipate problems during the school. Yeah.
So it sounds like, from a, you know, we're the primary care doctors, we find these, you know, cafe au lait spots, we're like, you know what, we're concerned for NF1. It sounds like there's no specific imaging test that we need to be doing as we refer to you for genetic testing, but we should definitely get them to the ophthalmologist. That's like, that sounds like something that we can definitely do.
Correct.
Otherwise, we can get blood pressures as we do that as well and send them off to you. We were just kind of talking about this earlier, you know, who is that? You know, who generally manages NF1? What is your multidisciplinary team look like? Mm-hmm. Who's involved? You know, that type of thing.
Yeah, so that also depends where you are. So I'll say in Chicago and Cincinnati, the neurofibromatosis program is run by genetics. Yeah. So clinical geneticists, usually pediatricians, are the ones running this multidisciplinary program. Yeah. If you go to CHOP, it's under oncology. Yeah. If you go other places, maybe under neurology, yeah, Washington University. Yeah. So it's quite variable in terms of which specialty runs the program, but it's usually under the umbrella of an NF1 comprehensive center, which if you make a referral, typically is a multidisciplinary team. Yeah. So in our team, we actually have an eye doctor, yeah, just because, again, it's an important criteria for diagnosis, but it's one of the most common complications in the young children. So we want kids to have access to that evolution right from the beginning, yeah. So that is important. We have a genetic counselor, lots of family education, if we're going to do testing, and if we're going to do studies in at-risk family members, that's important as well. Then the geneticist, who is familiar with the condition as well. And you could have other specialists in the same clinic, or you could also have designated providers that you work with. So a specific neuro-oncologist that is familiar with NF1 and will be the one managing the tumor complications. Yeah. Neurologists, which, again, developmental risk for seizures, but also developmental physicians for the kids that may have autistic manifestations or they have specific learning difficulties that may benefit from more tailored plans. And then orthopedics, yeah, for the bone complications on the severe spectrum, the tibial cervicothoracic, but scoliosis can be quite common with NF1 and many times needs surgery. Yeah, so that's also an important complication to screen for too. Yeah.
So I have a quick question. What would you say, or how would you triage like a rural outpatient pediatrician if he or she is seeing an NF1 patient that they would suspect would meet all of the diagnostic criteria, but they might not have access to like a nearby children's hospital? Is there one specific specialty that you think they should send to or something they should do?
Yeah, so it's challenging because there's not an NF1 center in every state. Yeah, there is good partnerships. I feel like there is, and now with telemedicine, there's maybe more opportunities for families to connect. Yeah, for care for rare conditions. Yeah. But while they're waiting, I think the eye doctor, as we mentioned, that will be an important evaluation to have just to screen for that complication. Yeah, and then geneticists are probably a little less popular than pediatric neurologists. So that may be another good specialist to see while you're waiting to see the NF1 center as well. Yeah. So those could be good options. There's lots of good patient resources. The Children's Tumor Foundation, yeah, has a very good website with resources for newly diagnosed families, and also bring a network of physicians and resources they can access in families. Yeah. So that's also very important in their journey.
So one question we'd like to delve into on our podcast with almost every with every type of disease process is there are a lot of things outside of just pure like clinical presentations with our patients, including social determinants of health. Can you talk a little bit to that on some of these? I assume it does disproportionately affect some of these patients, and can you discuss like what are some of the things that you're able to help overcome them? We discussed a little bit about rural patients already, but and other things that you come across?
So NF1, yeah, definitely affects all races. Yeah, I think some of the challenges are when being such a common condition, it really affects every socioeconomic status as well. Yeah, so but there's bigger areas of the population that are more under-resourced, depends on where you live, yeah. So that we realized that was a huge need for our clinic, so that's why we incorporated a social worker, yeah. So we can do, in addition to disease needs, make sure they have transportation, yeah, and they can come to all these appointments. The advantage of having a multidisciplinary clinic is just reduces the burden for families to take off work, yeah, to see 3 or 4 providers. So having a multidisciplinary clinic, although it's maybe not the most sounding from the business perspective because it's not as efficient, yeah, it's actually very family friendly and family centered. So that is a benefit to the patients. Yeah. When we have familial cases and you have patients that have and parents that are affected as well, you have to also make sure you bring the information down to a level that is good for the affected parents to understand the importance about adherence, follow-up, and what to look for. Yeah. And they may also have more economical impact if they're not as independent or they're not able to have as good of a job. So you also have to account for that. Not that this doesn't happen on the non-familial cases, but we probably see a lot more here in that group. And probably another challenge is the locations. So sometimes clinics are not really located in the neighborhood, so that brings another disparity. So I think telemedicine can help with some of that, bringing care a little closer home, but it doesn't necessarily always work for conditions that you have to examine and do a more in-depth physical exam and reflexes and all of this. So that's a limitation for this condition as well. Yeah.
So we kind of talked about the social determinants of health. There's another thing. I think myself, like being a medical student, and I think other learners at different levels as well, the skin findings can be hard in general, any skin finding to even describe or like articulate it. What advice would you give some of our learners or clinicians for identifying skin findings in patients that might be of different ethnicities or skin tones? Like, are there any good resources out there, or would you just curbside a pediatric dermatologist, or how would you necessarily go about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are a couple of books on for pediatric dermatology that really focus on the skin findings. I think the Cafella spots, I guess I'm a little biased. I don't find them particularly difficult, but I've probably seen hundreds and hundreds of patients, yeah? So, which is a little different, yeah? But yeah, curbside in a pediatric dermatologist, if you have a friend pediatric dermatologist, may be easier, yeah? But maybe in the future, we'll have more machine learning that helps you with some of those decision-making maybe in the future. I have a couple of friends that are working on recognition of Cafella spots too, yeah? Yeah.
So we'll stay tuned. We'll stay tuned for that. I think we can make it on to treatment. I know that sounds like what you had kind of teased it a little bit with maybe new therapies for decreasing plexiform neurofibromas. Can you kind of walk us through the mainstays of treatment for kids with NF1?
Yeah, so treatments. So if someone has an optic glioma that is causing vision loss, this kid really needs urgent care to know, okay, this is time to do chemotherapy or not. Yeah, and that typically will be guided by neuro-oncology. There's a couple of regimens that are shown to maintain vision and hopefully improve, yeah, some of that vision loss. Yeah. And of course, what we will want to is to catch it early before they are symptomatic, yeah, to be able to start treatment the sooner, yeah. Now, for optic gliomas are actually quite common in NF1, but not everybody needs therapy. So let's say out of 100 kids that I see in clinic, 15 to 20 will have an optic glioma, so relatively common, but only maybe 1 or 2 will need treatment. So it's not necessarily always that we make the diagnosis that means needs therapy. Therapy usually if we have symptoms such as vision loss, such a location of a tumor that we're worried about where it's present, or precocious puberty that is secondary to the infiltration of the tumor. So that those are red flags that will help, will take you there, yeah. The plexiform neurofibromas, yeah, if they're growing fast, if they're pushing an important structure, they typically, so surgery is an option, yeah, so you can have debulking surgeries. The challenge with those surgeries is you're debulking a nerve, yeah, and if you debulk a nerve, you're going to lose some sensation and maybe mobility. They also have a chance to regrow. Yeah, so it's not necessarily, they may take a while to regrow to where they were, but they, that's another complication. The treatment that got recently approved, so one of the good things of COVID and 2020 was the approval of selumetinib. Yeah, so selumetinib is a MEK inhibitor. So we talked that RAS pathway overactivation, one of the key proteins in that overactivation is MEK, which is in the downstream of the pathway. So a drug that inhibits the activation of MEK actually is a potential treatment for all these conditions in the pathway. Yeah. So you got approved for children with symptomatic plexiform neurofibroma that are non-resectable, which is the majority because all the complications we mentioned. Yeah. But what this treatment shows is that in a subset of children can lead to reduction. Yeah. 50, 60, 70% of the size of the original tumor, which actually can lead to a lot of improvement in mobility, less pain, better cosmetics, yeah, as well, yeah. But not every child responds to the medication, so it's not a cure, yeah. And it may take at least 6 months to a year for someone to show improvements. It's not necessarily a rapid response, yeah. But in some patients, you may have symptoms that get better, such as pain control, yeah. So you will be monitoring tumor growth, symptoms, yeah. You have to do frequent imaging to measure the response to those medications, yeah. And like any medication, there are side effects. So there are additional tests, blood tests, echocardiograms, eye exams, in addition to the ones you do looking for those medication side effects, yeah. But that, we don't try to make those a barrier. We just try to make a good plan that families can follow. Probably the most common side effects that are bothersome to family are skin side effects, yeah. So inflammation of the nail bed, paronychia, you can also have rashes and acne. Yeah? And acne can be problematic in children, yeah, in teenagers. So that's something that we really want to manage as we start these medications. Yeah? There are other MEK inhibitors in clinical trials, so likely we'll have more opportunities. There are also clinical trials looking to see if those MEK inhibitors work on other tumor types, yeah. Such as the optic glioma. So there's a couple of clinical trials looking at that. And there's also a study looking to see if they actually help with the neurofibromas on the skin. Yeah. The superficial ones, those are typically benign, but when there's so many, they can cause, again, cosmetic problems. But if they're located, for example, in the elbow and you hit it a lot, that can cause pain. So those small neurofibromas can actually be removed too. There's different techniques, and we actually advise to remove some if they're in an area that, like the belt area, and the kid is complaining of pain. So those can be removed easily. Yeah. So we typically send them to a pediatric surgeon. If they're located on the face or skull, we probably will do a plastic surgeon. So it depends on the location, is that the surgeon that we typically refer to. And then the managed blood pressure, or if they need stents and other procedures based on those other complications as well. So lots of different management opportunities. And then learning, yeah, which is probably one thing that we're hoping hopefully these new medications may have some activity in the brain, but it has not been the primary endpoint of any of the clinical trials, but maybe a secondary endpoint on some of the newer trials to see if this medication that we use for the tumor complications may actually help with some of the neurocognitive aspects of the condition. So we'll know that later. And there's also adult recommendations, but I mentioned one that may be important. It's also a common risk factor for early onset breast cancer. Yep. So we typically recommend to patients, the mothers and the kids are going into college, hey, you probably need to start early onset at age 30 screening for breast, because internists may not be as familiar with this being as a risk factor as well. So we try to do that as well. So lots of education, basically.
And this might be an ignorant question because I don't know much about oncology and some of these things, but it sounds like this is a RAS tumor suppressor gene and that we're trying to, our systemic treatments now are downstream for the MEK. Like, has there been trials for coming up with RAS inhibitors or things to go after that pathway, or is it just better to do the MEK pathway?
No, that's a great question. So yeah, so we actually are lucky that the RAS pathway is really well studied in cancer. And that means it's actually very important for a lot of adult onset tumors. So KRAS for lung cancer. So there is a new type of medications that are called RAS inhibitors. Yep. And now are druggable. It used to be thought that these are undruggable targets. Yeah, but now they're actually chemistry got really smart, and now there's lots of different drugs that can target this. So those are in clinical trials. I anticipate some of those may come to be used on NF1, and there may be other trials looking at other targets outside MEK and or pan-RAS inhibitors. There's lots of hope for new therapeutics in this condition.
Awesome. So it actually sounds, you know, just to not to simplify this too much, but it sounds like when you think of the treatment pathway, you're really almost thinking oncology treatment pathway. Okay, if it's really big and in a location we can take it out locally, we'll take it out from whatever surgeon would need to do that. Or, you know, hey, if it's not in a resectable place like behind the eye, for example, we might need chemotherapy. And then as we advance our chemotherapy agents to something even better, like small molecule stuff. And so right now we're in MEK inhibitors, but who knows where we'll be down the line.
Yeah. And I will say, yeah, that's a very good assessment. Chemotherapy historically has not been the best option in the sense because these are benign tumors. So they're typically not proliferating a lot. So usually not. So usually I believe the future is those more molecularly guided therapies for this condition. Yeah. And for a lot of cancer, it's all molecularly guided now, yeah.
And then I'm just going to summarize this to see if I got this correct, because it's been, as we treat these kids, we monitor them in routine screenings. You know, we talked about earlier annual ophthalmologic exams. We talked about no specific imaging just yet, whether that comes down the pike, who knows. But right now, you just do it based on symptoms. So if you have, you know, head symptoms, eye symptoms, you know, you might get brain MRI. If you got something that's in the anywhere in the spinal CNS, something like that, that you would spine MRI. And then we do developmental screening in the sense classically annually just to make sure that we're in a good spot. Are there any other screening tests that we should be doing that we missed, or if I summarized that incorrectly?
No, that's a very good assessment, plus the blood pressure and the growth charts are usually very useful, especially if you have someone going into precocious puberty and someone that has growth deceleration, growth acceleration. That may be another reason to do imaging. I mentioned there's not recommended guidelines, but we're doing more whole body MRI, especially in teenagers, yeah, which because they're able to do the study unsedated, they're able to cooperate, they're able to be part of this decision making, yeah, that hey, we're going to do this to see if there's anything internal that you need to be aware of, yeah, for symptoms reporting or for option for therapy. And there's some really cool studies coming as in terms of not necessarily prevention, but early onset treatment with these medications to see if that prevents actually those tumors to become very symptomatic or to even develop at all. Yeah.
So I know you mentioned that in your multidisciplinary clinic, you guys typically have like a social worker. What anticipatory guidance would you give parents at like their well child checks or in like other support that you would have to take into account for these patients, like school support, such as an IEP or things like that?
So requesting an IEP, I think, is always good. So 504 plans, accommodations, for attention. So we know a lot of these kids have difficulty just paying attention, which is not uncommon these days in the general population. Yeah. But accommodation in the classroom, make sure that if there's any vision concerns that also accommodate for that. And then, an early IEP assessment with neurocognitive testing will be advisable, yeah. And then screening, emotional screening, yeah. So some of these kids can be a little bit more prone to have depression, yeah. Another thing we screen in clinic is sleep issues. Also, sort of sleep actually comes underappreciated a lot in chronic conditions just because there's a lot of other things going on. But if the child is not sleeping at night, so that means the whole family is not sleeping, and then there's other chronic issues that come out of that. So and there are now good medications that can help with that as well. So that that will be important, yeah. And then, I think with our social workers, we also make sure there's no food insecurity, which is not necessarily specific to an F1. It's just an important aspect of care, as well.
All right. So I really appreciate the amount of time you spent with us tonight. I learned a whole bunch, definitely a lot of things that I never knew about NF1. I probably should have known well back when I was doing my boards, but we've corrected that. And I think a lot of our audience will be much better prepared for this, especially as they're seeing this in clinical practice. One of my last questions I have is, what's the prognosis we have here? Sounds like we have lots of, known treatments now, newer treatments on the horizon. What are you telling parents in terms of prognosis with their patients or these patients as they're getting older to understand their diagnosis and how to look at their life moving ahead?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think that's a huge challenge. So it's the prognosis can vary widely depending on the severity of the condition and the complications that every child may have. Yeah. So we do a pretty good job kind of going over potential and anticipated risk by age groups, yeah? And that can be overwhelming to a lot of families. So you got to read the room and kind of paste the information based on the family as well, yeah? There is some good resources that we provide them that are also drafted by some of the organizations and national organizations that helps kind of get them to read and then have that easy contact, a close visit to just kind of go over questions that come out after that initial diagnosis. Yeah. There is 1/3 of the patients that may have very mild to no learning difficulties. So we have some that have become doctors too. So they do very well professionally too. So, but they have some that really need a lot more supervision and parental. So in right now, unfortunately, there's not a test I can do to predict that severity, yeah, which is a big challenge for some families. Yeah, I feel like it's all, as you summarized pretty well, we are coming with a lot of guidelines, treatments, opportunities, which I feel will make the condition better, but there's still a lot of challenges and a lot of unknowns and a lot of potential complications that we don't have a treatment yet. Yeah. So still a long road for a cure, yeah? But also genetic testing and disease understanding continues to evolve. So some of my research is on genetic modifiers and biomarkers and try to provide more risk stratification. So I feel like as the technology advances, we may be able to be a little bit more or provide a little bit more certainty to families. But right now it still is a pretty wide prognosis, yeah, for these families, but many get to adulthood and many have a very good also life. So not everyone has the extreme complications that you see in the movies or the internet, yeah.
And so, with all these things that you're talking about, what really excites you in the next couple of years that you feel is coming right down the road that our patients with NF1 should be looking forward to?
Yeah, so I think I'm very excited about a couple of things. One is the more treatments. So we will have more than one MEK inhibitor in clinic, which it just, again, opens options and give patients more opportunities for therapy, not only for children, but also for adults. It's kind of funny. This is one of the conditions where the treatment is approved in children, not in adults, yeah? Kind of the opposite of what we're used to in pediatrics, yeah? And then two, the diagnostics. So our group works a lot in whole body MRIs and biomarkers, and there are some very cool ways to measure the pattern of fragmentomics of the circulating DNA from the tumors to know which patient may be developing a more complicated tumor or malignant tumor. Yeah, so that's a new technology that is not yet in clinic, but I will be in clinic, and that's at 10 to 15% lifetime risk of a malignization, which is relatively high. And having a test that can allow us to identify that and get ahead of the game, that will be really cool too. Yeah. as we get better on the tumor aspect, I feel like this is going to translate into cognition, which is probably one of the most debilitating aspects of the condition. Yep. And right now, very limited therapies. Yep.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Prada, I think I speak on behalf of, I know myself as well as Sam and Chris here, that we thank you so much for your time and joining us here at the Gripsiders. We've all learned a lot. Hopefully this will be very helpful for some of our listeners as well.
I hope so too. And I need more geneticists, so happy to talk to anybody. Great. Thank you guys. Yeah.
Do you have any last take home points for our listeners before we sign off?
Take home points. So yeah, think about NF1. So cafe on the spot. Don't be shy to refer. We don't get upset. Yeah. Again, more 5-6. If you're questioning another one, just send it. Yeah. And genetic testing is becoming a more usable tool also for diagnostics, in, especially in NF1. So yeah, lots of learning, and keep asking good questions. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you guys. Yeah. Good night, yeah.
The new number is...
This has been another episode of the Cripsiders.
It's for the kids!
For the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecripsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producers for this episode, Trevor Hoag and Dr. Rachel Holloway, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter and Facebook. I've been saying
maybe Blue Sky. Maybe.
Yeah. I'm Trevor Hoag.
And this has been Chris the Chew Man Chew. And since I did such a poor pun at the beginning of the show, I decided to bring back the AI poem if you guys made it to the end. It's titled, The Spots That Tell a Story. Little spots of cafe au lait, like gentle freckles on display. Neurofibromatosis type 1, a journey that has just begun. Beneath the skin, a story grows that every caring doctor knows. From nerve to bone to soft tissue near, changes that bring both hope and fear. Each child, unique in their own way, needs guidance through each passing day. In childhood years, the signs unfold, some subtle, some more clear and bold. With watchful eyes and gentle care, we help them through the path they share. From optic gliomas, silent signs, to freckling where the sun shines. See you guys. Thank you.